the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek, and this morning, Scott Greenberg and I are joined by science journalist and former NPR science correspondent David Barron. He'll share his new book, The Martians, the true story of an alien craze that captured turn-of-the-century America. He'll talk about how that craze shaped science and culture, and also the parallels to our current time. Very interesting stuff and a great conversation. And then we speak with the Natural History Museum of Utah. It's coming to Park City's Community Science Night on September 12th. It's a free event with a demonstration by Utah artist Anna Evans. The Science Night highlights an exhibit that just began, last week at Zions Bank in Kimball Junction. It's all about art, ecology, and hands-on science exploration for all ages. So stay tuned for that in the second half. We'll be back after these words. You're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek.
And I'm Scott Greenberg.
Today, we're diving into a fascinating and often forgotten chapter of American history when turn-of-the-century scientists, journalists, and the public became utterly convinced that Mars was not only inhabited, but populated by intelligent beings.
Our guest today is David Barron, science writer and author of The Martians, the true story of the alien craze that captured turn-of-the-century America. We'll talk about how this alien obsession took hold, what it reveals about the relationship between scientists and storytelling, and why we may still be vulnerable to similar fads today.
David Barron, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me.
When I was reading through your book, all I could think about is, wow, wouldn't it have been amazing, the whole Martian craze today with the internet and social media? It would have been different, but multiplied times 100, probably, the craze.
In fact, I mean, my book tells a historical tale, but it's a historical tale that I think speaks to today. And that's one reason that it is a story about science and the media, but also we are looking for life actively right now in our solar system, on Mars, and elsewhere. And now we've got the James Webb Space Telescope looking for, and other observatories looking for exoplanets, planets around other stars. I would not be surprised if in the next 10 or 20 years, there is at least a suggestion that life has been found, if not intelligent life, on another planet. And we may well see our own modern alien craze, like the one I write about, that happened at the turn of the last century.
Right. Well, yeah. And if you look up the Mars exploration that's taking place now, of course, we're really familiar with things like Mars rover Curiosity and others. But I looked up how many different variations of the Mars exploration is taking place. And it's stuff I've never heard of before, you know, beyond SpaceX and NASA. And it is really taking shape. And I wonder how that will inform the craze. Will it inform it with better information? Or even we've proven that even if we do have good information, it can take its own life, right?
Well, so, you know, we've been as a culture obsessed with Mars for more than a century. I mean, I think it continues today. As you say, there are many spacecraft on Mars. Part of that is because Mars is right next door. Mars is a much easier planet to study than Venus. So there are practical reasons why we go to Mars. But Mars, in the public imagination, has this special place. It seems like it's a planet of mystery and romance. And that does go back to that period at the turn of the last century that I write about. We have often projected onto Mars our own hopes and dreams. That happened a century ago. I think it's happening today. Elon Musk, who wants to start a new civilization there, I think there's a lot of excitement about what he suggests, also a lot of controversy. But is it realistic in anywhere near our lifetimes to have a city of a million people on Mars? I don't think so. And if we do have a new civilization on Mars, are we going to really correct the problems of Earth? I tend to be skeptical about that. So we have to be careful that we don't project onto Mars what we hope is true rather than what is true.
Well, today we have these modern day influencers, if you will, right? You know, they're all over the internet. But at the turn of the century, last century, you had several characters that you write about in your book that were, for lack of a better word, influencers of their time and really started this entire craze that took over a nation of, oh my gosh, what's on Mars? Tell me about a few of those characters.
Right. Well, certainly the most influential influencer at the time was Percival Lowell. He was an astronomer. He was really an amateur astronomer, but he came from a wealthy and highly regarded family in Massachusetts. When he graduated from Harvard, he could have done anything he wanted with his life for the first 20 years. He became a writer. He traveled the world, wrote best-selling books, wrote for the Atlantic Monthly. But as he approached the age of 40, he became fascinated with Mars and decided to dedicate his life and his fortune to studying Mars and whether, in fact, it was inhabited by intelligent beings. He founded the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, that probably many of your listeners know of or maybe have been to. It's still there, still doing good work, but it was established by Percival Lowell specifically to look for life on Mars. And he believed he found incontrovertible evidence that there was a civilization there. So he was by far, he was not only a scientist, he was an influencer. He was an incredibly persuasive writer and speaker. He was out there promoting his ideas. But at the same time, there were other scientists and other writers who latched onto this idea. A little known character was a science journalist named Garrett P. Serviss, who was incredibly influential back at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th centuries. He wrote a tremendous amount about the supposed civilization on Mars, and he and the newspapers he wrote for really spread this scientific idea out into the popular culture.
Yeah, but by the way, I think you also mentioned Alexander Graham Bell and maybe Nikola Tesla in your book. But these influencers of the time, they literally sparked an entire generation of new science fiction. I mean, of course, everybody knows the very famous Orson Welles, you know, the Mars radio show, right? But it went way beyond that. This was really the beginning of a brand new genre.
Right. So let me speak to both of those things you talked about. Yeah. First of all, Alexander Graham Bell was convinced. I mean, by the early 20th century, he was an elder statesman of American science. Of course, he had invented the telephone, but he then went on to do many other things. He was one of he was the president of the National Geographic Society for a while. He bought into the idea that there was a civilization on Mars. And Nikola Tesla, the genius inventor who is responsible for our modern system of electrical generation and power distribution, he, in 1899, while studying what was then called wireless telegraphy, which today we know as, which became radio, but he was studying whether you could send signals wirelessly through the air, Nikola Tesla picked up these weird radio signals in 1899 that he believed came from Mars. And when he told the world that he had picked up the first interplanetary radio transmission, that just propelled the craze to a whole new level. And it did enter science fiction. H.G. Wells wrote The War of the Worlds in 1897. And that in 1938 was adapted for the radio by Orson Welles. But in fact, you may know of the literary awards called the Hugos. They're named after Hugo Gernsback, who is considered the father of American science fiction. He really pushed science fiction into the craze it became in the 20th century. Hugo Gernsback said it was because when he was a child, he read one of Percival Lowell's books about the supposed civilization on Mars, and he just went so wild with his imagination that it changed his life, and he dedicated his life to imagining travels through outer space.
Mm. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with science writer David Baron, and he's joining us to talk about his new book, The Martians, the true story of an alien craze that captured turn-of-the-century America. David, were you captivated by science fiction, or were you more captivated by the anthropological look at this cultural craze. Where did you come up? What was the genesis for you?
Well, so part of it was from my childhood. I wasn't really a big fan of science fiction, although I watched Star Trek on TV when I was a kid. But I grew up in the 1960s, and you know, Martians were just part of culture. On Saturday morning cartoons, Bugs Bunny would be up on Mars battling Marvin the Martian, who always seemed to be dead set on trying to destroy the Earth. There was a popular sitcom in the 1960s called My Favorite Martian. Martians were in the comics. The Martians were in sci-fi. But I then went on to study the sciences to become a science writer. And in recent years, I've been writing about astronomy. I reflected on my childhood about where did all that come from? Where did this obsession that we have as a culture with Mars and Martians come from? And when I started to do the research and I looked at old newspapers, I mean, I literally went into an archival database online. You can do it pretty easily now, search these old newspapers. And I typed in Martians for like 1890 to 1910. And I was just astonished at what came up. These full-page articles in the New York Herald and the New York Times, these serious newspapers, talking about the civilization on Mars and how we might be able to communicate with them and what the Martians might teach us. And I felt like it felt like science fiction. How in the world did people come to believe this? And the deeper I went into digging into the story, both the science and the cultural aspects, just the richer it became. And the more it spoke, I think, to human nature. It really is sort of about anthropology. Why do we believe what we believe? How do ideas spread? And that is a very contemporary idea.
Oh, absolutely. Well, looking at some of these scientists who, I mean, take Nikola Tesla, for example. You know, how widespread was his credibility when he came up with the notion that he heard Martian radio signals? I mean, we know of him now as being a credible scientist, but was it all part of sort of, I don't know, scientific theory and the way that we go about doing sciences where, you know, we hypothesize and we come up with a creative idea about something and then we go about proving it or disproving it. I mean, were these scientists credible?
Well, so interesting you ask about Nikola Tesla, because he sort of straddled the line between credibility and sensationalism. There was no question that he was a genius. And he really, I mean, he was living the high life in the 1890s, living at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York, hobnobbing with celebrities. The newspapers were always interested in talking to him. But he also was a showman. He liked to, he sort of had this mystical quality about him that I think he enjoyed to kind of hyping. So on the one hand, you couldn't dismiss him. He really was a technological genius. When he said he got the signals from Mars, well, the what was then called the yellow press, what today we would call the tabloid press, they really latched onto it because it was just made for good copy. But people didn't know what to think. He wasn't someone you could easily dismiss. Interestingly, people called him a visionary, which at the time was a pejorative. It was someone who can't tell truth from fiction, who imagines things. But he was a visionary in both senses of the word. He was also a visionary. And that's also a theme of my book, is imagination in science is critically important. It really is what propels us forward. Imagination is very important, but it can also take you down dead-end roads if you're not careful. And so it's this balance between having the imagination to think what could be true, balancing it with the evidence of what is true. And it was same with Percival Lowell, who was really pushing this idea as an astronomer. When he first came up with the idea that there were Martians, which was based on what he was seeing and others were seeing on Mars, it was, I think, a credible theory. But as the evidence came in later, suggesting that perhaps he was wrong, he never was able to accept any of the evidence that ran counter to what he believed was true.
But part of that credible evidence, wasn't it the theory that there were actually canals on Mars? I I think I've got that right, that they were seeing canals on Mars. And of course, well, canals, I mean, there must be something intelligent making the canals. Can you talk a little bit about what that was and how people actually bought into that theory?
Right. So that is how it all began. So it actually started in Italy in 1877. A highly regarded astronomer named Giovanni Schiaparelli decided to make a new and extremely detailed map of Mars. So in 1877, Mars came especially close to Earth. Mars and Earth come close together approximately every 2 years, actually 2 years and 2 months, the two planets come close together. But they come especially close about every 15 years. So in 1877, this was going to be a really good time to look at Mars because it would be especially large and detailed in the telescope. And Schiaparelli drew what he saw. He saw dark areas and light areas that he imagined were oceans and continents. Others had seen those as well. But he also saw this network of fine straight lines crisscrossing the planet. And he didn't know what they were. They were so straight that they almost looked artificial. And he figured, well, they're dark, like what he thought were the oceans. He figured they were waterways of some sort. And so the word he used in Italian was canali, which means channels, which, you know, he wasn't saying they were artificial. They could have been like the English Channel, narrow waterways. But it was mistranslated into English as canals. And so people started to talk in a kind of joking way about canals on Mars. Well, when Percival Lowell came along in 1894 and started studying Mars, and he too saw these straight lines, which by then were being called canals, whatever they were, his theory was they really were canals. Now, not navigation canals, but irrigation canals. It's a complex theory. I can't go into all the details, but generally speaking, the theory was that Mars was an older planet than Earth. It was actually a dying planet. It was losing its water. And the only moisture left was pretty much tied up in the polar ice caps, which really are there. You can look at Mars through a telescope and see these white caps at the North and South Pole that grow in the winter and shrink in the spring and summer. And so he thought, well, what the canals were, he said, were this was this vast irrigation network that the intelligent Martians were using to take meltwater from the poles and bring it down to their cities and their farms. And that was enabling them to survive as the planet eventually was going to be doomed and run out of water. So it was for a while, and I could go into more detail, but I think better to read the book for all those details. Again, it was not a crazy theory at the time, but over time, Lowell was able to accumulate evidence that these lines really were there. And he was such a good promoter. And then Tesla came along and said he got radio signals from Mars. By 1907, the idea had really caught on in the mainstream press. And so 1906, the New York Times was writing about this. The end of 1907, the Wall Street Journal, one of the most staid, phlegmatic publications in the country, announced at the end of the year that the biggest news of the year, 1907, was proof of intelligent life on Mars.
Amazing. And when you say, by the way, I want to repeat that the book that you're the author of, this wonderful book, The Martians, The True Story of an Alien Craze That Captured Turn of the Century America. It's fascinating. Now, during your research, you know, you didn't, you know, talk about the canals. We talk about the radio signals that Tesla claimed were coming from Mars. Were there any anecdotes or stories that you discovered that kind of made you laugh out loud at some point where you kind of went, no way, nobody could have possibly have believed that. But back in the day, this was so overwhelming. It captured our imagination so thoroughly. But today, is there something that you look back on and went, wow, how could we have like bought into that?
Well, this was also a time when spiritualism was really big. There were seances being held. People believed they could communicate with the dead. Telepathy was supposedly a big thing. And it, you know, the idea that, I mean, there are, of course, plenty of people today who believe you can communicate by thought. But it was actually, it was being studied by scientists at the time because all sorts of mysterious invisible forces were being discovered. X-rays were discovered in the 1890s. You could actually see through the human body. Radio waves were being discovered. So the idea that maybe minds could communicate just mind to mind, even over interplanetary distances, was thought to be possible. So there were people who claimed they were communicating with the Martians by thought. And at seances, they would talk to them. There was actually a famous case of a medium who lived in Switzerland who, when she would go into a trance, she would transport her soul to Mars, and then she'd come back and she would speak in the Martian tongue. And that actually, it's a really interesting case because her name was Helene Smith. That was the alias she was given. There was a scientist in Switzerland who studied her, and there were people who thought that she was going to Mars when she'd go into a trance. This was a prominent psychologist in Switzerland who studied her and wrote a whole book about her because he actually found it more interesting in terms of what it said about human psychology. He did not believe that she went to Mars. This was all in her imagination, but it was such a rich imagination that she had invented this whole other language when she would speak in tongues and she would speak the Martian language.
That's really fascinating. So did Helene Smith, when she spoke in her Martian tongue, was there any linguistic analysis into it? In other words, was she consistent?
It seemed to be pretty consistent, but so the psychologist who studied her actually studied the syntax and the grammar of the Martian tongue. And what he discovered is it essentially was French. The words were bizarre, but the grammar and the syntax were French. And of course, French was the language spoken in this part of Switzerland. So that was part of the reason why he concluded that she really wasn't going to Mars, but she believed she was. And the unconscious part of her brain was inventing this entire fantasy.
Yeah, I love it. It's so great. Well, it's funny when you talk about Percival Lowell being a wealthy amateur astronomer. My first thought goes to, I just conjure up an image of Elon Musk. You know, no coincidence or at all that he named his car company Tesla after a visionary like he is. You know, imagination and vision is part of Elon Musk's, you know, daily vocabulary. So I'm wondering, you know, as you look back at this really interesting time in history and you're drawing parallels with what is going on now and then our new, you know, our ability to explore to a certain degree Mars, do you find yourself prognosticating about what's going to happen with Mars? And have you been correct in your theories?
I dare not prognosticate. Predictions about what's going to happen in terms of exploring Mars have been wrong time and time again. I mean, since the 1960s and 70s, people have been predicting, including Spiro Agnew, Vice President of the United States, Carl Sagan, there are these famous statements about, oh, we'll have a human on Mars in 15 years. It always seems to be 15 years from now. And my prediction is we'll have a human on Mars 15 years from now. I think the 2030s is a reasonable guess, but that could well be wrong. But I do think that, you mentioned, of course, Elon Musk. I talked a little bit about this earlier, but why is he so excited about Mars? Because he sees it as the opportunity to create a better world, which is a wonderful thing to want to do. That actually is very similar to the excitement about Mars at the turn of the last century. The Martians, even though the best known piece of science fiction to come out of that era is The War of the Worlds, where the Martians were these evil creatures that we feared would come to Earth and conquer us, that was not the common view of the Martians. The supposedly real Martians that Percival Lowell had discovered were a peaceful, moral, technologically savvy, inspirational civilization, to the point that by 1908, when, again, the Wall Street Journal declared in 1907 that it had been proven that Mars was inhabited by intelligent beings, by 1908, you had pastors in church sermonizing about the Martians and saying that we should emulate them. And beyond that, there was a thought that the Martians were, in essence, could become our saviors if we could only communicate with them. perhaps they would be able to answer the deepest questions that we've had forever. There was a fascinating newspaper article that was published in 1909 in many newspapers across the country when there was talk of communicating with Mars. And the question was, well, what questions should we ask when we get in touch with the Martians? Well, you might think it would be practical questions about technology, how to build a canal, for instance. The questions on this list were these deep philosophical, theological questions. What is the meaning of life? How can we prevent human suffering? Where does the soul go when you die? These were the questions the Martians would answer. So back at the turn of the last century, the period I write about in my book, people were looking to Mars to save us. That's what Elon Musk is saying today. And it's not just Elon Musk. There's a group called the Mars Society that's made up of scientists and enthusiasts who really want to get us as a civilization onto Mars so we could start over and do things better. That, you know, that's a wonderful thing to want to do. But one of the lessons of my book is we have a tendency to kid ourselves, to blind ourselves. We're so in love with Mars that we don't see the flaws in our thinking. And I think we have to be careful about that today, too.
This is fascinating. And by the way, I just want to go back to Helen for a second, where she was communicating in her Martian tongue, which was actually French. Would it actually explain why my favorite restaurant in France is Font de Mars?
River
in Paris, got to go to Font de Mars, fantastic. But that was the craze then. Let's move forward to today. And what craze are we looking at beyond our own atmosphere? I mean, we've got the Hubble, we have the Webb, we have the Vera C. Rubin Observatory now online. And we're looking further out than we ever have before. I think maybe, are we heading into a period of looking beyond Mars, and are we looking at possibly life on other planets, the exoplanet craze? I kind of feel like we're heading into that generation now.
I think so too. I mean, you know, there is still an active search for life in our solar system. The Perseverance rover is on Mars right now, picking up rocks, sticking them in tubes with the hope that someday they'll be transported back to Earth for geochemists to look for signs of life, perhaps fossilized life in those rocks. We're probably talking about microbes, if anything, on Mars. There's the Europa Clipper that's on its way to the moon of Jupiter. There's the possibility that there's life in a subsurface ocean on Europa. We don't know. But in our solar system, I dare say, we're not going to find a civilization beyond Earth. We might find a civilization on a planet elsewhere. There's the SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, has been going on for decades. Tomorrow, it could turn up a signal or a potential signal. And when we do find evidence of life or intelligent life out there, it's unlikely to be incontrovertible. It's probably going to be a hint. And it'll be really interesting to see what happens with that hint, whether a hint of intelligent life takes off again and spreads now through the internet and influencers on TikTok and becomes a new craze. It will be the most exciting thing in my lifetime if we do find strong evidence of intelligent life out there. I would love for it to happen. Whether it will happen in my lifetime, I don't know.
David Barron is our guest. He's a science writer and author of the book, The Martians, The True Story of an Alien Craze that captured turn-of-the-century America. Okay, a great idea. It's been raining here in Park City, so how about a rainy weekend with the book, The Martians? When is the release date?
It just came out a few days ago.
Okay, so get your copy of The Martians. Maybe it's a good time also, because as you've been talking, I've been thinking about that film, Arrival, from 2016, that talks where the linguist goes and tries to decipher the language of the extraterrestrials that have landed, of course, in Montana. And and as you talked about, that also was an opportunity for these extraterrestrials to help us correct what we've messed up on on this planet. So very interesting. David, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Lynn, Scott, it's been my pleasure.
Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg.
Hey, Park City, on September 12th, 6 to 8 p.m. at Zions Bank at 1483 New Park Boulevard in Kimball Junction, the Natural History Museum of Utah is coming to you.
Explore the natural world around you through learning stations hosted by the Natural History Museum of Utah, hands-on activities, museum specimens, and by talking with NHMU experts who want to answer all of your questions. The Community Science Night highlights a traveling exhibit about how organisms defend themselves from defense mechanisms to protect themselves from predators, the elements, and other dangers they encounter.
Featured at the exhibit are the works of one of our next guests, Anna Evans. She joins us now along with Katie Worthen, who's a community programs manager at the Natural History Museum of Utah, along with Brittany Comer, the branch manager from Zions Bank. And welcome to all of you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Katie, let's start with you. You know, we often talk about the wondrous place that the Natural History Museum of Utah is. You're making it that much easier for us and bringing this exhibit that runs for about a month, going through most of September, here to Zions Bank. What a concept. Tell us more.
So the exhibit is part of a program that we've had with in partnership with Zions Bank for over 20 years, might be almost 30 years at this point, where we bring real objects from our collections to different Zions Bank branches throughout the state. And one of the locations for this year is going to be the New Park Branch here in Park City.
Brittany, maybe you could comment on this. I guess banks typically have lots of extra space, but how much extra space do you have in that branch to be able to set up this Natural History Museum of Utah exhibit?
Our lobby is spectacular. It's very open. And so we'll have about six displays from what I understand, and just a great place for people to come in, visit, and enjoy the exhibits that'll be on display. We've got plenty of room.
How did this partnership come about?
Well, my understanding is that way back in the 90s, a couple of people who were board members from Zions Bank and then also the Natural History Museum were talking about how we could be better at being the state's Museum of Natural History. They also were interested in eventually building the new building that we have now. And one of the ideas that they came up with was to have a traveling exhibit that would go to these different Zions Bank branches, which are throughout the entire state. And would help provide the security that these actual objects from our collection would need to go out on the road.
That's going to be exciting. And I want to actually touch on a very special part of your exhibit. Anna Evans is a multidisciplinary artist who literally builds her work from the ground up. She uses desert materials, agates, and even plants that she grows on her own regenerative farm. That's really pretty cool. And I know that this is all rooted in her Western ecology and culture. Anna, I understand that you're blending traditional art, symbolism, sustainability in this exhibit. Tell me, how does this fit in with the whole idea of defense experts in nature? I'm really curious and looking forward to seeing this.
Well, I haven't actually made any part of the exhibit. I'll just be at the event that's going to open the exhibit, doing a demonstration and kind of an art project for people who are there.
Well, tell me a little bit about your art and what you will be talking about then.
Well, I'm a naturalist, so a citizen scientist, and I use a lot of science in my work because I grow plants and I have to identify things out in nature when I'm harvesting from nature to use dye plants like rabbit brush and that sort of thing. So I will be doing a mineral pigment watercolor demonstration. So before synthetic pigments were invented, everything was a natural pigment. And so I've kind of gone back to that, and I collect soils and stones around the state and use those to create watercolor paint that I then make paintings with. So people at the event will have an opportunity to make their own little painting.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. I can imagine that. I mean, I remember as a kid trying to find things out in nature that you could smash up and then use as paint. And I think this must just capture the minds, the imagination and creativity of anyone that you do these demonstrations for. Inherently, children are so much more imaginative and creative than we adults have somehow, you know, evolved to not become. But talk a little bit about your audiences and how you really turn people, both children and adults, onto this.
I think that it's, people are really interested because it's kind of unconventional these days, but it's, I feel like the pigments that I use kind of capture the desert a lot better because they are the tones, the literal tones of the desert. I have a broad range of people who enjoy my art.
I bet. And where do you live exactly?
I'm in Helper, Utah.
Oh, okay. Well, that we know that's a big artist community.
Definitely.
Great. Well, let me just reintroduce all of you. We are talking about a really great community science night that's going to be coming to Zions Bank branch at Kimball Junction on September 12th. It's from 6 to 8 p.m. We're joined this morning by Brittany Comer, who's the branch manager there, Katie Worthen, who is with the Natural History Museum of Utah, along with Anna Evans, who will be presenting this great project. Again, I'm Katie, maybe you can talk about this. How much room is there at Zions Bank? How many people can come to this community science night that is free, by the way, to experience Anna's great work?
How many people show up? We'll be able to accommodate however many show up, but like, I mean, our better attended ones can have over 200 people. And so like, I would like to see at least that many. Not all of the event will be inside of the branch. It's nice outside, we hope. And so there will also be activities outside from other community partners, as well as volunteers from the Natural History Museum. I know that we've got one of the partners that we're partnering with besides Anna is the Swanner Eco Preserve, and they're going to be open late that evening for this event so that people can visit both locations, which is pretty cool.
Well, I just pulled up the website, and I have to say, yes, it's in a bank lobby, but these display cases that you have set up, first of all, I'm glad they're enclosed, just in case those those things in nature that have great defenses try to get out. But tell me some of the things that are in those cases that I'm looking at. What's on exhibit that are going to be great examples of defense mechanisms in nature here?
So we have six cases total in the exhibit, and each case features a different area from our collections for living defense mechanisms, like adaptations that animals and plants have. We've got like a prickly pear cactus. We've got skunks that people know about. But then we also have one case from our anthropology collection that has some baskets that talk about Utah indigenous folks have spiritual practices where, you know, people who use certain symbols or do certain ceremonies or things like that, they're spiritual protectors of the community.
And am I seeing a butterfly in one of these cases? Tell me how that's a defense mechanism. Is that something they camouflage or blend in, or what's the deal with the butterflies?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, like there's camouflage, like there's butterflies that like they have wings that appear like different eyes and things like that. There's like two different defense mechanisms for butterflies and moths that are featured in that case, and one of them is camouflage.
Okay, well, this sounds really fun and exciting. And again, I'm fascinated by this partnership between the Natural History Museum of Utah and Zions Bank. Now, for those who do not know where Zions Bank is, I'm glad, Katie, that you mentioned the Swanner Nature Preserve, an eco center. Zions is right next to the restaurant Bartolo's, right across from Cafe Rio there at Redstone in Kimball Junction. It's great that you're sort of partnering also along with Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Now, what will they be doing on that evening?
I believe they have some sort of activity where there'll be components that you do at both locations. So like if you want to like complete the whole activity and get the reward of completing the whole activity, then you have to visit both locations. I'm not sure exactly what sort of secret fun thing they have planned, honestly, but I know it's going to be awesome, whatever it is.
Okay, great. Well, they always have great things planned there. Again, yes. This is taking place. It's a free event co-sponsored by Zions Bank and the Natural History Museum of Utah. It's taking place September 12th from 6 to 8 p.m. So be sure that you head out there. You can just show up, right? You don't need to make a reservation or anything like that, right, Katie?
Yeah, no, it's just open to everyone in the public. You don't need to make a reservation. We'll have four other community partners there, as well as Zions Bank in Anna and the Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. We have the Park City Museum, the Summit County Library, and the Alf Eggman Ski Museum will also be there with some fun hands-on activities from their locations.
Great. So this is a really big community event. Brittany, maybe you could answer this question about, you know, the importance of bringing art and culture and natural history as a bank. Some people may think that's an unlikely partnership, but I really love that something like Zions Bank, it makes this a priority.
It's definitely special. And I grew up in Eastern Summit County. So I've been born and raised in the area my entire life. Small town, very rural. These kind of things didn't travel out that way. Even in our elementary schools, we didn't really get a lot of exhibits. We didn't, you know, it was very minimal when we had assemblies and things like that. It's growing in excitement, so that's wonderful. But being able to have these events out in rural communities where people are traveling an hour to Salt Lake or 30 plus minutes to Park City, it's special. So having that access for those individuals closer to home in the great community of Park City, it's just a great fit. And Zions loves to have everybody in the community involved. One of our goals, our mission is to make sure we're connecting with all walks of life within the Zions Bank footprint. So this is just one more way for us to be able to do that. And I'm very excited to see all the new faces that are going to come through the door, not only that night, but, you know, in the 30 days that we'll have the exhibits here at our location. So I'm super excited to meet the people that are going to be walking in to take part and enjoy the exhibits that are on display and just have some great conversation. I'm sure we're going to learn so many new things that we never even could have thought, you know, about defenses. And it's just going to be a fun night, a fun month. And we are looking so forward to it.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it as well, particularly the hands-on part, as long as I'm not going to get bitten by anything that's defending itself. And I would love to talk to you a little bit more about the art that you're going to be doing with the natural pigments that you find in nature. Now, you're going to be doing, I guess, a live demonstration of using your watercolors that you've developed. Is there going to be any opportunity for a hands-on participation with interaction with you?
Oh, definitely. I'll do a demonstration about how I make the watercolor pigments, how I mold them from and have all my tools on hand so people can see the process. And then I'll have palettes of paint for people to use and they can make their own little watercolor painting that they can take home with them.
How cool. So I can come make, I guess, an agate blue sky but actually, what are some of the minerals and things that you're using for your art?
Oh, sure. Ochres, clay. I mean, Utah's full of clay. It's a great source of pigment because it's such fine particles. A lot of the like mudstones and stuff, there are so many different colored stones out here that you can have a whole spectrum of color. But then I actually use Japanese indigo that I grow on my farm as the blue pigment because a lot of the blue pigments in nature are from copper and there's some safety issues with processing copper pigment. So Japanese indigo is a little bit safer for kids.
And what's the process you use for making the pigments? I mean, are you grinding them or boiling them or?
Oh yeah, there's a couple of different processes depending on what the stone or what the mineral starts as. If it's a rock, you pulverize it and collect the tiniest particles. I have like a sieve system that collects like the very teeny tiniest little particles. And then if you have like a clay, you can levigate, which means you put the clay into water and then stir it up and the clay particles will stay suspended in the water where the other pieces that are in the clay will kind of drop down to the bottom and then you pour it off. So it's kind of a long process. But then everything, once you have the very fine particles of pigment, you mull them, which you use like a glass muller, which kind of looks like the bottom of a wine glass or something, but very thick glass, and using gum arabic, which is a like sap from a tree, honey, and I use pinyon pine oil. Some people use thyme oil, but it protects it in like, so you don't have to use preservatives in it. You mull it, put the pigment with the medium on a big glass plate, and then stir it all together. And that suspends the tiny molecules evenly throughout the, because if you just stir something together, imagine like putting chocolate chips into cookie dough. If you, when you stir them in, they kind of like clump all together, but using the muller, it will like evenly suspend everything into the mixture. So then when you have the dry watercolor, you can get it wet with your brush and it will easily come off in a uniform way.
Anna Evans, she is an artist from Helper, Utah, and she is a multidisciplinary artist. I'd love to hear this about, you know, your processes, Anna. I was recently, I was in a museum, and it was this famous weaver from several hundred years ago who used, it was a Norwegian weaver who used, created her own pigments for her thread to do these incredible, these textiles that several hundred years later are still very vibrant with these pigments. And so I'm curious about, is this unusual to be an artist that creates all of her own pigments?
I think a little bit. I mean, it's becoming more popular these days because it's a fun process. I also grow all the pigments that I use in my fiber art. I'm primarily a fiber artist. And so I have a little farm where I grow a bunch of different plants that I use to color wool and fabric to then use. And it's, you know, it's what people used until the late 1800s when synthetic pigments were invented.
When you were describing the process that you use, what was it, a pine oil or something to preserve them so that you can keep these pigments? You don't have to create a pigment each time you're having a session, right? Do they, how long do they last? What's their shelf life?
Pretty indefinitely. I mean, it's, the main concern is when you're getting the watercolor wet and then you put it back in your palette and then it sits in that wetness, it could grow mold, but by putting something that's antimicrobial into it, it will prevent mold from growing on top of it. And pinyon oil is antimicrobial.
Ah, all right.
And I just like to use that because it's natural to hear.
Right, right. So in your garden, you mentioned that you have, that you grow indigo. What else do you grow? Take us on a quick tour through your garden.
Oh, sure. I grow coneflowers, marigold, madder, which use the roots to make a very deep red. Red is kind of a difficult color to achieve from nature. Sunflower, there's a particular Hopi sunflower. The black sunflower seeds create a purple dye. Yeah, I can create an entire spectrum of color from the plants that I grow.
Wow, I'm looking forward to seeing this and I'm excited. I am really fascinated by this, these three women that we have here today with us. And I have to say that it's an incredible collaboration between Zions Bank, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and a wonderful artist. It's a multidisciplinary artist. And by the way, I encourage everybody again, this is going to be September 12th at Zions Bank from 6 to 8 p.m. And that's the Zions Bank out in Kimball Junction, 1483 New Park Boulevard. Looking forward to that. I guess the question I would have is, how did you all come together for this? I mean, I get that there's the theme of the defense mechanisms for the Natural History Museum, and then bringing Anna in as a natural artist. How did that collaboration occur?
The way that the exhibit process works is usually that our exhibits team at the museum comes up with some theme ideas, and then we talk to Zions Bank, and together we pick one of those themes to really develop into an exhibit, which of course this one is defense experts. And the exhibits team works with all the different disciplines that we have at the museum that have collections and picks objects that will kind of like fit into that theme. And then our statewide engagement coordinator comes up with like a schedule of different places that we can get. We try to get all over the state on like a multi-year rotation. So we pick some locations that it'll visit during that year and propose that to Zions Bank. And they usually have some ideas about places that would be great for it to visit as well. And then once it's finally on the road, we have a few locations that are going to be these community science night events. And we try to come up with some really great partners, particularly ones who are local to the community that we can invite to do some awesome hands-on activities and really like have a nice community event that has a lot of representation from all the different awesome things that are happening in each of these places.
Well, it's a really wonderful way to turn people on to natural history, to science, to art, and this is really important in our communities. So all of you Park City area residents, head on out to Zions Bank for this community science evening, September 12th from 6 to 8 p.m. and enjoy Anna Evans, our artist, who will be there demonstrating and giving you the opportunity to do your own watercolor with natural pigments. Anna, are you going to be coaching anyone on how to do a watercolor?
Oh yeah. I mean, there's certain techniques, but I didn't go to art school or anything. So I like when people kind of bring their own way of doing things into it. It makes for some interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Anna, just one more question. Where are your projects and your artwork on display, if anywhere?
Oh, sure. Well, kind of back to the last question, they just did it at the Zions Bank here in Price, Utah. And I think they saw I have a big solo exhibition at the Prehistoric Museum in Price. And it's examining the relationships between symbiotic organisms in the desert. And so I think that they saw that how I'm combining science with art and that it might be a good fit for some of these events.
Oh, that's great. The Prehistoric Museum in Price. I didn't know that existed. So another opportunity to go learn a little bit about especially what goes on in Utah. So, and then just to mention that Traveling Treasures will, it's Defense Experts. That's the exhibit that is being hosted by Zion Bank at Kimball Junction. It began on August 29th and it runs through September 26th. Wonderful. Well, Katie, Brittany, and Anna, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. It's really keep up the great work, all of you, and we're looking forward to the event.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.